Robert Gottlieb is one of the most celebrated editors of the last half century. His list of authors and titles includes some of the finest writing in all categories produced in that time period, like Catch-22, True Grit, The Power Broker, and Beloved. And now he's written a memoir about that career called Avid Reader, A Life. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Robert Gottlieb back to our show. Hello.
Thank you very much.
Does every author need an editor, even the great ones?
Well, every author should want an editor. Some need them more than others. I love the editorial process. So whether I'm the editor or the editee, I'm equally happy because it's fun going over all that stuff.
Well, I would assume that the person who edited this book was a little intimidated.
Oh, no. No, no, we know each other far too well. No, and also, I also have friends who are either professional or semi-professional editors whom I show things to, and they chip in, and I gather comments. My wife is a wonderful reader, my daughter. So it all adds up.
I've spoken to authors who believe that the more input you get, the better, and then others who say they don't show it to anybody until they've completed it.
Well, that's right, and every author has a different need, and our job as editors is to fulfill that need. I don't have a personal agenda. If someone wants me to read it chapter by chapter, that's great. If someone doesn't want to show it to me till it's in the stores, practically, mm-hmm. that's great, too. Our job is to serve the author's need.
I remember reading about a late Faulkner book that was inconsistent. It was all the words were, certain words were hyphenated in the first half of the book and then compound words in the second half of the book. And the reason is that the editor was so intimidated about going to William Faulkner and saying...
Oh, I would have been too.
Now, I'm curious about the title. Avid Reader... A life, it almost sounds like an understatement of your career and what you're writing about here.
But it's not an understatement about my life, because probably the key to my conscious life has to do with reading. The actual title, the phrase, comes from the fact that when I left Simon & Schuster, I was editor-in-chief there many, many years ago, to run Alfred A. Knopf, the headline in one of the stories about, I think it was in the Times, I can't remember, was Avid Reader to Run Knopf. So that turned me into Avid Reader, and since I still am an avid reader, it seems appropriate.
You say that you initially had no interest in writing a memoir.
Initially and after. The thing is...
Well, while you were working on it, what happened?
I thought it was a pretentious thing to do. People asked me when you talk and you tell stories and say, oh, that's so interesting, you should write a memoir. What an idea, you know. But it was about 15 years that I said no. And then on the one hand, my publisher, who had been great to me, wanted me to do it. But more important was that my daughter, whose every word is my command, wanted me to do it so that her twin boys, they're now 13, would one day, if they were interested, have a record of what their grandfather did to spend his life. So that's why I finally agreed to do it.
But the book is also fascinating to other avid readers.
Well, I hope so. It would be great if it is.
Is it true that you read at the dinner table instead of talking with the other members of your family?
My parents. There were no other members of our family. And the dog. But the dog wasn't at the dinner table.
That wasn't considered odd?
Well, it was normal, so it wasn't considered odd. It was not the most functional of families. And we were all insane readers, so that my mother, my father, and I would frequently each have a book. There wasn't much to talk about. And in between courses, my father would jump up and make some phone calls, and I would jump up and do some reading or some homework, and then my mother would call us back, and then we'd sit back to our books. It was always so great dinners.
As an aside, I was surprised to learn from your book that the writer of Pat the Bunny had written a previous book that you were enamored of called Junket.
Junket is nice.
Yeah, is that still in print?
It came back. The New York Review of Books publication people brought it back. It was out of circulation for decades because there was a legal problem with the Junket people, apparently. Mm. I was so happy when it came back in time for me to reread it for this book that I was writing.
When you began publishing houses were different, weren't they? Were they willing to take more risks than they are today?
I don't think that's necessarily true. Publishing houses are always taking risks because that's the nature of the business. They were smaller. When I went, my first job was at Simon & Schuster, now at Behemoth, but then a funny little place where a lot of pals got together every day and had a good time. And as my beloved friend and colleague Nina Bourne once said, it was like having one family more than you need. That's really no longer true in the kind of publishing houses that are known. There are smaller and more intimate ones, of course, and maybe those are a lot of fun too.
Well, we keep on hearing about how they're so much more focused on the bottom line these days, or they're willing to publish books that they never would have published in the past simply because they know they're going to sell well and they'll pay for the books that they believe.
Well, that could be true in certain houses. I mean, each one is really very different from the others. But the quality houses, to use a kind of snobbish word, would never go below a certain level. And no sane publisher would really publish something that he or she didn't have some enthusiasm for. Otherwise, it's not going to work.
Although there are a couple of books that you write about here that you don't sound all those that enthusiastic about.
Well,
like Michael Crichton's books.
But when you see when the Andromeda Strain manuscript came to me, which was his first novel under his name, it was thrilling. It just was a mess. And you could see what a terrific book it could be and turned out to be.
It needed an editor.
That book needed an editor more than most books need an editor.
How would you describe your major strengths as an editor? Is it having an eye for a good book?
Well, that's more a strength as a publisher. I think my major strength as an editor is that I love books and that I have a sympathy for authors, because the crucial thing for an editor working on a book is to have a strong sympathy for the book itself. And so it leads the editor to help the writer make the book better of what it is. When you don't like the book and you want it to be something other than what it is, only tears can follow.
There are lots of stories about books that are messes, like the Andromeda Strain, some people have suggested that the editor should get some credit as co-author.
No. Editors get far too much credit. I mean, I think I put in the book that after Catch-22 was starting to take off, I heard Joe Heller on the radio one day. Oh, no, I'm sorry. There was an interview in the Times, which he gave me endless credit, and I had to call him up and say, you've got to stop this, because readers don't want to know that there's somebody between the writer and them. Editors should be invisible.
You got that book through Candida Donatio, but it was Catch-18 at the time.
It was Catch-18 at the time, and it stayed Catch-18 in the 4 or 5 years it took Joe to finish it from the time that we took it on.
They just sent you some pages?
It was about 50 or 60 pages.
And the strength of that was...
Oh, absolutely, because it doesn't take very much, if you're a good reader, to know right away whether there's a voice, a quality that you like. And if you can see that the author has the ability to keep going, you don't need more than that.
You were only 26 at the time. Did that give Heller some reservations?
He was already 26, a veteran. I guess, when we met. No, Joe was much too smart to take abstract things like that into account. He said later that he was sort of surprised to see this kid, but immediately we got along wonderfully and had a fantastic lifelong relationship.
My guest is Robert Gottlieb, who's written a memoir called Avid Reader, A Life. It is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Do you read differently when you're reading for pleasure than when you're reading for work?
But I'm always reading for pleasure, except when I don't have it.
Do you just read 15 pages or so of a book and say, this is not for me, and just stop?
Actually, it's worse, because I will often, if it comes from a reputable source, I will often read a page or two and know perfectly well I'm never going to want to publish it, and then I will read 400 more pages out of some kind of obligation or insanity. I want to be sure. I want to see how it works its way out. I want to see if my first impulse was justified. Usually it is.
Do you read other than for work?
I never stop reading. Mm. If it's not a book, it's a magazine. If it's not a magazine...
Are you still reading at the dining room table?
No. Well, if I'm eating alone, yes.
You were an editor of the Columbia Review when you were in college. Did you imagine a career as a journalist or a writer or a critic?
Oh, I never imagined any career because I thought at that time, I think that my sensibility was so refined that work would damage it. I mean, I was totally unrealistic and I didn't think ahead. I've never thought ahead and I've never really looked back. That's why this exercise was rather interesting for me.
Were you doing something similar to what you did later at the Columbia Review?
No.
You weren't editing?
I was editing pieces. No, that was more an issue of bringing things in and putting them together rather than line editing.
Now, you don't only talk about editing here. You talk about your personal life, and I don't know how far we want to get into that.
It's up to you.
Your first marriage, which was when you were just out of college because your girlfriend got pregnant?
Well, that was the basic thing. But we'd been together for quite a while, and she got pregnant. It never occurred to us to have an abortion. First of all, in those days, that was not a light thing to do.
It was illegal, and
Well, it was illegal, though there were ways to do it. There was the famous East Coast abortionist in a small town in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want that. I mean, there was going to be a person coming. Fine. We were not equipped to be parents. We were not equipped to be married. But I'm certainly glad we had our child.
And your families weren't pleased, neither family.
Well, our families didn't know about it for a while. Mm-hmm. And when they found out, they were not amused.
But did that put a crimp in your desire to have a career?
Nothing to do with it. I didn't have a job. I was 21. I was at Cambridge when our son was born in England. Mm-hmm. And when we got back, obviously, since there was a family, I had to find work. I didn't even know what kind of work.
And you just wound up in publishing by accident?
Well, yes and no. When the chips were down, publishing was what I was clearly suited for because I had always been fascinated by it as a hobby. My first subscription to Publishers Weekly, I used my 16th birthday money to acquire because I loved the history of publishing. Who published what? Which were the book club selections? How well did it do as a bestseller, etc.? It was like a hobby. I liked the statistics and the facts. It never occurred to me to be in it, but it never occurred to me to be in anything.
Hadn't you already been rejected at Simon & Schuster by their advertising director, Nina Bourne,
yes,
before you were sent by an agency to look at another job there?
That's right. I was rejected by Nina, who turned out to be probably the closest friend I and my family have ever had, part of our family, until she died at 93, still 6 months before her death, going into Knopf occasionally to do her magic. Yes.
Did she apologize to you?
Oh, no. It was a joke. She denied that she'd ever seen me. And about 3 years after we were there, within weeks, we were united totally. She ran into my office and saying, look what I just found. And she found a note to herself saying, see Robert Gottlieb, from the person who had sent me to her. And of course, when I got to know Nina, I understood. Her mind was working on whatever ad she was composing. So she didn't even notice the surround. I could have been Goethe, and she would have not looked at me.
I'm speaking with Robert Gottlieb, who is the former president, publisher, and editor-in-chief of Alfred A. Knopf, former editor of The New Yorker. He has written and now currently a dance critic, among other things.
Correct.
He's written a memoir called Avid Reader, A Life. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, which is not one of the publishers he worked for. We'll take a little break here. How about that?
Sure.
And then we'll come back with more.
Excellent.
We're back with Robert Gottlieb. He's written a memoir called Avid Reader, A Life, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. So what kinds of authors and books did Simon & Schuster represent at the time that you went there? You went as an assistant to Jack Goodman?
Right.
Jack Goodman, what was his position?
Well, I believe his title was something like editorial director, because Mr. Schuster clung to the title editor-in-chief. But what Jack was the editor-in-chief, as well as really the publisher in many ways.
And Simon & Schuster at that time was publishing books like Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Well, that went back to the 30s. Mm. Simon & Schuster published every kind of book. Mm. And that was a lot of fun for me because I read every kind of book. So there was no consistency. They were seen as a sort of highly commercial, not exactly tacky, but not exactly elite publishing house.
Calories don't count, for
well, that
example.
Was the worst of it, although maybe the most successful, since it sold about 2 million copies in 3 months.
You got involved with Rona Jaffe's The Best of Everything. Was that one of the first books that you worked on?
Well, it was the first big commercial success I worked on. I had done a number of other things before. Rona was a college friend at Radcliffe with my associate and great pal, Phyllis Levy, who also worked for Jack Goodman. She was his secretary. I was his assistant, but she made $10 more a week than I did because she took shorthand, which I could not do. She was great. So Rona came to her with the idea of this book. And at the same time, Jack Goodman had made an arrangement with the famous Hollywood producer, Jerry Wald, to look for properties for movies. And then Jerry Wald came up with the idea of commissioning books that could be movies. And when Rona came with this idea, Phyllis and I took it to Jack, Jack took it to Jerry, and the next thing you know, there was Rona on the bestseller list.
And then Jack Goodman died.
He died at 47, which to me seemed perfectly normal. I mean, 47, you die. But it was awful. He was a wonderful guy, and his health was terrible. And he just went of a heart attack suddenly, as I say, at the age of 47, leaving the rest of us without him.
And some of the older senior people left.
Everybody left.
Leaving the publishing house in the hands of the kids?
Well, some of us were more kid-like
than
others.
Were you at 24?
No, I was at that point 26, grand old man. What happened wasn't just that Jack died. It was that the firm was sold. It had belonged to Marshall Field. And when he died, his estate wanted no more of it, so it sold it back to the two of the original owners. And they didn't hire anybody. Everybody, the head of everything left, leaving us there. Nobody said do it, and nobody said don't do it.
So we just did it. It's a great opportunity for you.
Well, it was great because it was so much to do. It was so exciting.
And then you, how did you find Jessica Mitford's The American Way of Death?
That came through, again, my friend, the agent Candida Donadio, because I was whining to her one night on the phone that I was supposed to be this hotshot editor. I never thought up ideas for books. And I said, the only idea I've ever had for a book was about American funeral practices, and I've never done anything about it. And she said, well, that book is being written by one of my clients, and it's under contract to another publisher. Well, it fell away from that publisher, and I snapped it up, and history was made.
I got to get back to Catch 22. Mm-hmm. How did you decide on 22 instead of 18?
Well, to use the word decide is to exaggerate. What happened was, in the spring of 1961, when we were preparing to publish it that October, we saw in Publishers Weekly that the new novel by Leon Uris, whose previous book, Exodus, had been a phenomenal bestseller, was to be called Mila 18, mm-hmm. and was also about World War II. So that was the end of Catch 18. So we were without a number, and we were flustered. So first somebody came up with 11, but this was at the time of Ocean's 11, mm-hmm. so that wasn't going to work. Then Joe thought of 14. Well, for whatever reason, I said, I don't think that's funny. So I was lying in bed one night stewing over this because it was a debacle, a disaster. And I suddenly thought 22, and I called Joe in the morning and said, I've got it. 22, it's even funnier than 18, showing you the depths of delusion that one can sink into, because no number is funnier than any other number. But at least it gave us a number, so we plowed on.
And you have to wonder what would have happened if it had been Catch 18.
The exact
same thing.
Probably
would have sold well. You say that you and Nina worked on the marketing campaign, including sending out what you called demented governess letters. What were they?
Well, that was Nina. Uh-huh. So Nina, who was the most impassioned and personal marketing person the world has ever seen, when she really loved a book and got behind it, she would write to everybody she could think of very personal letters saying how much she loved them. And in fact, I think I put this in the book, she once sent a book to André Malraux in Paris for a quote. It was about insurgents in Malaysia or something. And he wrote back and said, I never give quotes, but I am writing to you because of all the things I've ever received of this sort. Your letter is by far the most brilliant and convincing, and I want to congratulate whoever it is who wrote it.
Evelyn Waugh, you reprint his response to Catch 22.
He did not like it. He thought it was unpatriotic, which perhaps it was.
You also got involved with the publishing of William Shearer's The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. You weren't the editor.
I was not the editor.
But you got involved with coming up with the title. What was the proposed title in that one? The Rise and Fall of the 22nd
Reich? There was no Rise and Fall. No,
18 Reich?
I just don't even remember. You were going back 50 years or so. What happened was one of my colleagues, Michael Korda, alerted me to the fact that this was a terrific book. So I immediately read through it, and I went in and said at the next promotion meeting, or whatever meeting we were having, sales meeting, I said, you cannot do this book in two volumes as you're planning. That's the death. The title is terrible. The jacket is terrible. We have to rethink this. So I was so boorish and brash and sure of myself that everybody said yes, yes, yes. So we ended up changing the title, changing the jacket, and changing the printing and the format. And now, then I sold the paperback rights for a huge amount, more money than any other book had ever received.
I want to get to Knopf, but we should point out that you, part of the story involves John Kennedy Toole's Confederacy of Dunces, Chaim Potok's work, True Grit, Sylvia Ashton Warner's Teacher. So you were really in there at a good time.
Well, it's always a good time if you're publishing books you like, wherever it is.
Well, those are good books.
Those are good books.
So why did you go to Knopf? Did they just offer you a better deal?
Oh, not at all. In fact, one of the conditions I made for going to Knopf, that I would not receive more money than I was already receiving at SNS, because I didn't want what was for me a life decision to be affected by money. I had enough money to live on. It wasn't a lot, but it was fine. No, I was getting restless at Simon & Schuster. I'd been there 12, 13 years. It was all fun. But also the ownership change did not look good to me. And when one of the owners, a man named Leon Shimkin, brought us all together and said, rather drunkenly after his 2-martini or 3-martini lunch, you know, I just want to say how happy I am that it's taken me all these years to bring all of Simon & Schuster together with me running it. It's taken this long. There were so many people in the way. And at that moment, my friend Nina and I looked at each other and thought, isn't the way we want to spend our lives.
So did she leave as well?
Oh, yes. She and another friend, Tony Schulte, all left together to run Knopf.
And Knopf at that time, you say, was rather moribund, but you did have some pretty good writers there. John Cheever, for example.
No, he was not there.
Oh.
No. We had Julia Child. Mm-hmm. We had John Updike. We had, not a writer because he was long dead, but we had the work, the art of Khalil Gibran, who's the prophet, was essentially paying our salaries. There were good writers, but the place had lost all its energy, and it needed a lot of reinvigoration.
Who brought Toni Morrison to Knopf?
Toni?
She was already editing for another publisher.
She was working at Random House as an editor, and of course Knopf is part of the Random House group. And after she published her first book, a wonderful book, The Bluest Eye, with a different publisher, everybody at Random, starting with Bob Bernstein, the president of it, said, this is ridiculous. We have a wonderful writer working for us. We should be publishing her. But she couldn't publish for the Random House trade division because she was in it. So I was the natural person. We knew each other and liked each other, the exact same age. It was great.
You were not the first editor to work on Robert Caro's The Power Broker. How did it come to you?
Oh, of course I was.
You were?
I believe I've edited every word Robert Caro ever printed.
Wow.
It came to me through the agent, Lynn Nesbitt. Mm-hmm. Lynn thought that we should be interested. Why she thought I would be interested in a book about Robert Moses, who, although I'm a New Yorker by birth, I knew nothing about and cared nothing about, I don't know. But Lynn was always right. So when she sent this pile, this gigantic pile of manuscript over, I immediately started to read it. And within two pages, I knew how right she was, because it was brilliant. And so Bob and I started our long, long lifetime of work together.
You thought that LaGuardia would be the next subject, but it turned out to be LBJ.
Well, we had talked about it, because it took a long time to get this book ready. And during that period...
Why did it take so long?
Well, because it was gigantic. I'm guessing it was about 1 million words, whatever it was, 900,000 words. And we couldn't bind that many pages, even if we wanted to. So we both knew it had to be cut. And eventually we think that we cut about 300,000 words out of it. A horribly painful procedure. Because it wasn't just that there were too many words. It was that a lot of the words we had to give up, we loved. And starting with me, I didn't want to lose them, but we had to. So then we talked about LaGuardia, and that made sense because he was a fascinating figure. But finally, we separately concluded that it wasn't the right book, because what Bob was mostly concerned with was the use of power. And I said to him, you know, the person you should write about is Lyndon Johnson, because he exemplifies the use of power more than anyone in our time. And he had concluded that. So it was a kind of miraculous meeting of minds.
But we're still waiting for that project to end.
We're waiting patiently, sort of.
You also, we can't get to all of these people, Lauren Bacall, John le Carré. John le Carré, that must have been a thrill.
Well, it was great, because he's a wonderful person to edit. He, you know, some writers are natural editees. They love the process. They like going back into it. They like rethinking. They like restructuring, whatever it is. Others would be very happy to do that, but they don't think that way. Like my beloved friend and writer, Doris Lessing. Doris was perfectly happy to listen to anything I said, but her mind was no longer on that book. She was on to the next thing. David Cornwell, who is John le Carré, just loved it. So we had a thrilling relationship through many, many books.
Why did you leave Knopf for The New Yorker?
Because it was there. Also,
but did you realize it was going to be such a troubled situation?
Well, it wasn't a troubled situation. There was just a lot of fuss.
Well, Lillian Ross tried to discourage you from coming. She wanted Sean to hold on to the job.
Well, who knows what Lillian really wanted? The thing is, there had to be a change sooner or later. And Cy Newhouse, who at that point owned The New Yorker, was aware of it. And he was desperate, because he felt that the magazine was sliding into sort of desuetude of one kind or another. But he certainly wasn't going to fire the great William Sean, and who knew how long Sean would be able to continue. But something happened between the two of them. I believe they misunderstood each other, and he was leaving, or Cy believed he was leaving. And at that point, I took over.
How much were you able to change the magazine, because it already had a lot of works in the pipeline?
Well, I was able to change it as much as I felt I should change it. You see, I told Cy when we first discussed it, I'm not a revolutionary. I'm a conservator, or if not a conservative. And my idea was, as I work with writers of books, to make it better of what it is rather than to change it into something that it wasn't. So that was fine with him for a while, and that's what I did. I slowly... changed this, changed that, added this, deleted that. And then eventually he wanted something different, and we happily agreed to depart.
And he brought in Tina Brown.
Now
it's David Remnick. And you became a dance critic after you stopped editing. Is that an unrelated career? Do you see some kind of connection?
There's no connection. My life with dance started when I was 15 or 16 or 17. And I've always been a passionate dance lover and very involved in the dance. I helped run New York City Ballet for many years, etc. when I, in 1990 something or other, the New York Observer and its then editor Peter Kaplan and my editor Adam Begley wanted me to write for the paper, and I hate writing, but I said I would, and I started to write book reviews. And then Kaplan said, you can write, you can have a column on any subject you choose.
And you chose dance.
Well, first I chose shopping, because I thought that would be fun. But then I thought, no, common sense prevailed. And I thought dance. So I started that in 1999.
Robert Gottlieb's latest bit of writing, as much as he hates writing, is Avid Reader, A Life. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
You're very welcome.